Okay, so for this plenary, I'm very pleased to be able to welcome Phil Kashkash to the conference and to deliver this plenary for us. Phil Kashkash was born and raised on the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation in Northeast Oregon and is a Cayuse and Nez Perce person. He grew up with the traditions of those communities, including hunting and fishing and ceremonial activities. But he's a crossover into academia as well. He's at present a PhD candidate in the Joint Program in Anthropology and Linguistics at the University of Arizona. He's also a visiting scholar, American Indian Studies Fellow, advising Washington State University's Plateau Center. In 2005, he was a recipient of a Documenting Endangered Languages Fellowship from the National Science Foundation and National Endowment of the Humanities. This DEL fellowship enabled him to complete a year of language documentation fieldwork focusing on Nez Perce and Sahaptin in five reservation communities in the Southern Columbia Plateau of Western North America. Many of us know Phil for the ILAT Indigenous Languages and Technology list that he's established and runs, which always provides timely information about initiatives and things that are happening in regard to language documentation and conservation all around the world. He also runs a Nez Perce list, which is in Nez Perce, for Nez Perce people. He's written on an impressive range of topics, including Nez Perce verb morphology, Columbia Plateau rock art, reported speech in Nez Perce, and indigenous place names. So today, Phil is going to talk to us about documenting enduring cultures. So please join me in welcoming Phil Kashkash.
At the Kina Pining West, Ama Po Ka in West, we yield pu ka numipu titoken ka wa inim wanikt pitaminan max max ka kustita soyapo wanikt Philip Kashkash Inka in West. Inim watas, touch watas, kakustita kina ki, Waikiki beach at your touch. So I'm very glad to be here, and I want to thank the organizers for extending the invite to me, and I'm very, very pleased to be here in this landscape, in this island country. And but today I just want to correct a minor correction on my title. It should be Documenting Enduring Cultures, but traditions and cultures are pretty much the same. The aim of this talk is to provide an ethnographic description of Cayuse, Nez Perce, and Sahaptin communicative behaviors. I want to show how these communicative behaviors are organized and embodied as talk in the Plateau Longhouse, a ceremonial center for traditional life and culture in my community and in the communities adjacent throughout the Southern Columbia Plateau. I adopt an ethnography of communication approach to examine how present-day Cayuse, Nez Perce, and Sahaptin speakers utilize the linguistic practices of their speech communities at a time when their ancestral languages are endangered. The motivation for this study arises from me being a member of the community where I conduct my research, but more importantly, I must say that many of the teachings that I was raised with compelled me to do this kind of work, to look specifically at the relationship between language and culture, because that is the directive I've been given by my elders, especially my grandparents. So naturally, as a field site, I selected the Plateau Longhouse because that is the last vestiges of authentic spoken language in our culture. Because as many of you already know, that when languages become endangered, that the focus of the language shifts to the traditional sphere where it's much more conservative in language use. So my key interest is in this domain of research is learning how language use can accomplish the important work of transmitting culture to its community populace, and how speakers of Cayuse, Nez Perce, and Sahaptin organize their linguistic resources in doing so. You know, this important conference really is a reminder to all of us on the real task at hand, especially concerning how we collect data. And I've learned and will learn in the next day how that task is being done. And I am very thankful to all of you for your sharing. But as we are coming to know, and as our colleague reminds us, who gave the plenary earlier, was that the documentary goals of any language documentation are to obtain data on the observable linguistic behavior of heritage language speakers. And in this statement, I take the word behavior very, very seriously. And I hope to show this in my talk today. The urgent need to collect data, however, in my case, is grounded in real world concerns over the loss of our language and culture. In the diminishing base of speakers, the numbers are rapidly going lower and lower. In the time that I started my field work in 2006, the number of speakers I worked with, 8 of them have passed on. So my work strives to account for language phenomena not typically found in the linguistic record, because we always have large number of grammars and a few dictionaries and large archives of texts and audio recordings. However, little is found on the actual culture and life of our speakers. So my inquiry is based on human interactions that obtain their coherence through culturally organized communicative behaviors. Broadly conceived, then, my task is to conduct an ethnographic-based language documentation focusing on language use. The documentary goal in this type of approach is to develop a knowledge base of, one, language structure, two, language use, and three, the language or the culture of language. And this is the means by which we then begin to understand the real diversity of our human capacity to communicate within and across culture. Data on the observable linguistic behavior of Cayuse, Nez Perce, and Sahaptin speakers, in my case, were obtained entirely from video-based film recording. However, I must say that unlike standard recording instruments like digital audio or audio analog or other analog devices, the use of a video camera as a documentary tool is not a neutral recording device in the eyes of most linguists ethnographers or even community people themselves. This is because the use of a video camera tends to take on an anthropomorphic veil due to the way it mimics human perception and human embodiment. The more localized this mimicry becomes, the more subjective the camera viewpoint becomes. In other words, don't go Blair Witch Project with your video camera in fieldwork, right? Such subjectivity, as it were, lies outside the criteria for evaluating academic research. That's the real serious issue in using a camera. However, I found that acquiring data via an ethnographic-based language documentation approach mitigates some of the uncertainty in using a video camera, because in using the video medium, it is motivated in part by the real-world concerns that speech communities and speakers have about their language. So there's a shared commitment in creating an accurate record of authentic linguistic behavior emanating from the community itself. As an ethnographer slash filmmaker slash linguist, I adopted these same concerns as a prerequisite to my own filmmaking practice in these communities. So this practice translated into a non-interventionist use of the video camera in recording scenes, people, and the happenings before the camera. So in other words, my presence, or what I'd say my documentary presence in the community, coincided with many of the same observational roles many of the participants had while participating in the actual ritual activities themselves. So I sat with audiences to record behaviors, unless family members would come and direct me to bring my camera in certain locations. So I never, ever held my camera on my shoulder and walked around, because that was a very threatening and interventionist type of camera use. And in the first stages of my field work in doing that, it was people just basically shut down and wouldn't talk before the camera. So I learned to have all my equipment set up and ready to be turned on when I'd visit people, rather than, you know, taking 15 minutes to set up my equipment while they watch me, and when I turn on, nothing happens or they don't speak. And that has happened to me before. So what is to be accounted for by using a video camera in an ethnographic-based language documentation approach? As you well know, the axiom for any ethnography is to identify an aspect of social life and describe its patterns of behavior as they are enacted and rendered meaningful in the conduct of everyday life. So the approach here builds from the same axiom, in that it builds, or it's specifically concerned with documenting socially situated communicative interactions, with the goal of understanding how everyday language use motivates, gives meaning to, or otherwise organizes language, culture, and society. In filming, three empirical related domains of language use are the focus of my study. These are multimodal interaction, interactional structure, and linguistic practices. And this type of concern arises from the actual elements that come out of the video data itself. And so I utilize how the technology and its capacity to record behavior and try and or attempt to use it at its maximum potential. Multimodal interaction consists of multiple communicative modes that are employed in everyday interaction. In their most basic sense, they are modes or a set of signs with meanings and regularities attached to them, and whose form and interaction are typically expressed as spoken language, gesture, or gaze, proxemics, and other types of behavior that are embodied in our talk. So as meaning-bearing units of information, then all of these get simultaneously enacted when we interact with others. And that in itself is part of the multimodal dimension of this type of research. Interactional structure is the materiality of language expressed through the co-presence, coordination, and alignment of communicative interactants. So in interacting with others through speaking, conversing, or what have you, we all coordinate that with one another intuitively and naturally, and the camera does really well in picking up some of these coordinations. Linguistic practices are the socially constituted ways in which language is used, enacted, or otherwise performed, or otherwise it's just the ways of speaking communities have developed over time. So essentially, then, I look at what the repertoires language speakers or speakers bring to the communicative situation. And through these repertoires, then I'm able to collect the data on the types of behaviors that emerge out of these recording events that I've collected. Because this is a conference on language documentation where we are concerned with language data, I do have a slide for that. But as scientists, you know, we're all concerned about making structured observations. That's the real key, I think, for any documentation project, is to really maintain the notion of structured observation. In my case, I would say that in filming speakers and interaction, you may be able to say that, well, speakers have a little toolkit with them at every moment of their interaction. They have all of these elements within their toolkit to utilize when they go either to speak in public or to do certain acts within their tradition. So based on a single recording event, we may be able to obtain some of these observations, like observation 1, 2, and 3, like we see here. And if we record a similar event in another community, then we may be able to say observation 3, 4, 5, and 6 has similarity to what we just recorded previously. And that there may be then some validity in our observations that we make. So we might call this internal validity. And that's kind of the real simplest basis that I could probably describe, at least at this moment, of what I think I'm doing as well as you. And but further, one additional step I'd like to add is when we make these structured observations, then we might be able to say our data is patterned in such and such a way that we can call it a construct. And then from the construct, then we develop our analyses of these behaviors over populations or groups of speech communities. And this is, in fact, what I've attempted to do with my own work. My first finding, I do want to talk to you, or talk specifically about, in that speaking an endangered language, we might be able to intuit what that means. However, my talk and my work, I want to celebrate the speech community who I work with. I don't want to celebrate my data. I want to celebrate the fascinating, beautiful expressions of life that emerge from what I know in my experience and what is still present and alive in the communities. So when I say speaking an endangered language, I'm actually going to show you what that means, rather than just simply say, oh, our language is diminishing. We actually have to engage the level of endangerment internally at every moment because of the pressures from language shift. So hopefully this point will come through in this section. In the area that I work here, there are three languages. I'm a Cayuse person. So Cayuse went extinct in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So there are zero speakers. Cayuse shifted to Nez Perce, which is a native to native language shift, which is pretty rare, I think, in today's shift behavior. And then there's Nez Perce and Sahaptin. And as you can see, the numbers are fairly low. And especially Sahaptin, the dialectical diversity is, no one really knows what is remaining of the 15 dialects we currently have documented for Sahaptin. And in my work, because it is a visually oriented work, hopefully I can claim to say that I've discovered three signers of the North American Indian Sign Language family that still are able to converse and speak in the sign language system. And this was a very eye-opening finding for me, having a camera, because you then think visually and other elements enter into your questions about language and language use. There are 12 longhouses in the plateau area, and all of them are very active today. And each longhouse serves as a ceremonial center for traditional life, and the major ceremonials include the first food ceremony, the salmon feast, the huckleberry feast, winter solstice or Indian New Year observance, traditional naming ceremonies, funeral and death rites, and a memorial to a venerated ancestor. And those are the major ceremonials. There are a subgroup of minor ones that are also take place here. All ritual activities within the Plateau Longhouse have the potential for multilingual behavior due to the active participation of all of these linguistically diverse speech communities who share in the Plateau Longhouse belief system. In fact, many participants actively identify individual and group multilingualism as a source for one's identity. So this is a strong multilingual community now, slowly going towards changes in the system, but the multilingual viewpoint still exists in the speech behaviors, and I'll show that in a minute. However, like all of us are beginning to be aware of, is that throughout the world, you know, our languages are changing, and the same is here. So many plateau longhouses are diglossic in orientation due to the current ongoing impacts of language shift. The current trajectory of change in the language ecology is one from a strong multilingual language economy to a diglossic one, where there is a complementary distribution between indigenous and non-indigenous codes. However, in their most basic form, the linguistic practices of the within the Longhouse are differentiated by three characteristics. These are their spatial distribution, meaning that within the Longhouse, there are these spatial separations of space where talk happens. And then their temporal-based action sequences. And then third, their participant structures. All talk and all behaviors are oriented to sacred space. And as you can see here, the space is organized partly by gender, women on one side, on the southern side, and men on the northern side. And the spiritual leaders are on the western side. And everything is oriented to an east-west incline. So this is the space of talk in the Longhouse. But the most central component is a sacred area, or what's called a sacred floor, which is often a dirt floor due to the belief systems regarding the earth. As I mentioned, there are temporal-based action sequences, and these are multimodal episodes of communication where symbolic content are sequentially enacted from a paired sender-receiver communicative behavior. So as you can see, I tried to diagram this out into S to R, where S is the sender and R is the receiver. And these sequences are enacted throughout much of the ritual. And I forgot to mention as well that much of the space and the actual sender-receiver behaviors all index a symbolic realm of a dawn, a midday, and a sunset, and especially a symbolic earth called the lighted earth. And so these elements are components of every ritual, and speech forms index these elements in various ways. The third element is very meaningful to my analysis. Participant structures are primarily composed of group communicative interactions, and these group interactions consist of a mutual orientation to signs and messages, wherein the transmission of ritual content is transacted over the course of a ritual. This mutual orientation by ritual participants is based on the principle that anyone who participates in the Plateau Longhouse ritual accepts the idea, at least implicitly, that his or her pattern behavior is symbolically meaningful. So by that, I mean to say that if you entered into the Longhouse, your presence is symbolically meaningful, even if you don't say or do anything except enter. As I am moving toward describing the talk here, what we're finding as a major pattern throughout all the talk in the Longhouse is the ritual speech have three main components, the most important being the ritual opening and the ritual closing. But there is also now, kind of a manifestation of the contemporary changes happening. There's a multilingual plane where the indigenous codes are all spoken, and then there's an optional interpretive stance given to one speech, and that is usually in English. And many speakers now are adopting this multi-indigenous and non-indigenous speech form. So it has to do with the presence of kind of the composition of the present day community. The gradual introduction of English into the ritual sphere is a result of three time-related factors. The first is the loss of an older generation of fluent multilingual speakers. And second, a shift from a traditional multilingual language ecology to one of subtractive bilingualism, where learning English has interfered with heritage language maintenance. And then three, a dramatic increase of English monolingual speakers in the tribal population. So the emergent effect of this combined of these combined factors is that English is now being heard in the ritual sphere where it never has been heard before. Thus, the community responses then to the introduction of English into the ritual sphere provides us with an important opportunity to discover how communicative transmission processes are successfully rendered when the linguistic resources are severely constrained by endangerment. A very important study came out in 1976 by Searle, and I adopt his descriptive typology here to describe many of the behaviors I found that become patterned over many of the data I have. And the first one is what I'm calling, or what Searle calls, the world to word fit. That means you're adjusting one's talk to one's environment. And traditionally, this was always the default case in our community because it was a strong multilingual community. And many of the speakers among the older generation that I talk with spoke at least two, if on the average, and four to five on the more expert use. So you could go to a local community adjacent and you could change into the local code or vernacular and start conversing, and vice versa. So that was the common form. But because of that high tolerance for codes, English is now tolerated as an alternative code. So that is being introduced as a part of this word-to-word fit. So in the first example, then, I'm going to show there's a traditional Cayuse chief who's speaking in the lower Nez Perce dialect, and he introduces his talk, and then he shifts from his vernacular into English. I'll turn it to the start again. It's a very short clip.
It's a great honor to be here today. Glad that all of you people are here to witness this ceremony.
In that sequence, the chief was enacting a performance of recognizing the new chief that was emerging in this community. And his performance was to walk the length of the longhouse. And this was called laying down a trail of words. And the words are the virtues of living a good life and also being a strong, powerful leader for your people. So it was a performance that had really a symbolic meaning in all of his gestures and his walk. In the next example is what I'm calling the word to world fit. And this is where you adjust one's talk to cultural modes of action. And this is more of a contemporary one practice, I believe, because of the changes that are happening and the increasing awareness many speakers have about using their language. So in this example, there's a traditional leader speaking in English, and then he begins to explain that, well, this English really isn't the way we should continue with this ceremony. And so he shifts from English into Sahaptin, Columbia River Sahaptin. And in the film clip, you'll, rather than read it here, you'll hear it again. Statement, he said, we're going to open it up now, open up this space to allow the arrival of this new person coming. So, and it's really important to understand that in his statements, he said, it's the law. And in the Plateau Longhouse, the first laws or the traditional law is language is always the first language. And English is a borrowed code, a temporary code, and it's not, the rituals can't happen in a borrowed language. So in, just to repeat, in this world, or in the word to world fit, that is, as a behavioral sign, English is consciously managed here. And it's managed whereby the enregistrement, or what we're calling the formal use of language, the conscious use of language in a formal sense, is successfully rendered here as a normative code choice. In other words, the indigenous language is the normative code choice. So what are we to make of all of this? Well, I couldn't think of any other proper words to express or name it, so I came up with the term endangered language management. And due to the intensifying awareness of language shift and its potential impact on authentic language use, I propose a newly emergent set of linguistic practices, herein termed endangered language management. Endangered language management practices, at least in the traditional settings where I am from, are formed with two communicative goals in mind. The first being is to ensure the efficacy of ritual practice and ritual communication in the face of endangerment, and two, to limit or otherwise restrict the use of English as a code of communication. And I think this two pairing is really essential. One is you want to preserve something very, very important, very precious, and then two is that you have actual complementary behavior to block other elements which would prevent that from being expressed in whatever form. So a general theory of code choice as developed here may be able to make predictions on the status of endangerment when contingencies exist within a speech community. The range of language use between accommodation and resistance is revealed in the way code choices are linked directly to their transformative modes of behavior. Thus, endangered language management practices are centered on the virtues of enregisterment, meaning we're formalizing the language use, transmission, and ritual enactment. Otherwise, diglossic behavior becomes recognizable only as a form of subtractive bilingualism. My second finding is related to a broader issue about how we can begin to address the impact of changes as it is felt and experienced in our tradition. As a tribal member, I am very concerned, and as I said earlier, I want to be able to say that yes, we are a strong, vibrant, traditional people, and here's the reasons why. And I think I feel very confident that I can begin to explain the reasons why we are that way, rather than say that, you know, endangerment has caused this to happen, XYZ. So I'm very glad and honored that I am able to share this information with you. And I presented portions of this talk in Oklahoma earlier this year, and many of the elders came up to me and said, "We understand what you're trying to say." And that was such a big relief, because I think if I can make sense to the elders, then I'm very pleased. There are three components to a tradition. These are antecedent relations, cultural models of action, and verification. All of us might be able to intuit a tradition, maybe even within our family or within our community, but if you sat down to say, well, what makes the tradition the way it is, what are those components? And we could probably name and describe them, but in an abstract sense, these are some of the components of a tradition I feel that are related to the data I have. An antecedent relation is simply information or content which comprises a tradition must activate some relation to something previous in its history. It's very simple, but so simple that we might miss it entirely. And it really becomes key when we look at changes, because these relations are impacted by the changes we experience every day. So what happens then when there's a break in tradition, when the antecedent relation or some relation is broken in the chain, the long chain of events in the life of a people or a tradition? Well, that relation then begins to diminish and have impact directly upon those traditions, because there's no relation, right? But in a vibrant culture, when there's a break in tradition, you have a very urgent need. There's a gap in the tradition. And so we are compelled to fill that gap with something. And that's when we begin to borrow. And so throughout our cultures and throughout the ethnographies that have emerged in the plateau and elsewhere, I'm sure, is that cultures have borrowed extensively from one another in various forms or for various reasons, whether or not, in fact, this may be one of them. So that's one of the elements by which we may begin to see that changes happen, because we're feeling a gap in our culture or tradition. So what about this relation? Is this still a tradition? I don't know. I haven't been able to collect enough information to say yes or no, but at least intuitively I could say that if there's a horizontal relation, then maybe it might be something we'd call fashion. Or maybe in something like in the powwow cultures, horizontal borrowing, outright borrowing of dances, songs, is a contemporary everyday activity. And this heavy borrowing is a result of, I hate to say the word, but many people call it pan-Indianism, this type of behavior of collective coming together and just borrowing for whatever purpose. In an established tradition, modes of action are composed from signifying practices which are informed by a culture's stock of knowledge. So what do we mean then? Well, a culture's stock of knowledge is comprised of ready-made meanings or things that are common sense to us. And these are distributed among the community themselves. So the most common sense understandings may in fact be a stock of knowledge in the places you work in. A signifying practice are meaning-making behaviors people engage in following particular conventions and rules. So this is fairly straightforward, these two elements, in addition to the relations that they have to something previous. Probably the most important aspect of a tradition is the verification. A tradition receives verification when its content and associated actions are assessed in relation to a culture's stock of knowledge. So there's something now that's entering into the domain of content where people are actively assessing information and its meaning. So this active assessment then really has to be paid careful attention to. By that I mean to say there may be exceptional individuals who you come across in your fieldwork who can really express some of the most in-depth esoteric knowledge about the world. And this is really valuable because we, as we are becoming well aware, is that all stocks of knowledge are endangered, not just language, grammar and things of that nature, but knowledge about biodiversity, knowledge about place and sacred landscapes, knowledge of healing, knowledge of all of these elements that were thousands and thousands of years a part of our experience. Probably something interesting, though, about the verification process is that there are comparisons made about content, and this entails a demonstration of similarity or a kind of correspondence relation. And in fact, some of these comparisons may entail a truth condition. So when you actually hear someone talk openly about whether something is true or not, then that may be a key to pay attention. So I'm going to show a film clip here where you might be able to discern some of these actual embodied notions of tradition within a particular segment of video data that I have here. This is, I think, about 15 minutes long, but I'm going to show only the first 5 minutes. And as you'll notice at the beginning, and in addition to the earlier clips I showed, they are from one actual event that I recorded over 6 hours. And so this is like a day-long ceremony. And so the actual events are from the single recording event. But in this case, there's a naming ceremony taking place. And one of the people is transferring a name from a woman to a child. And so this actual transmission of the name is part of the idea, the main idea I want to convey is that transmission, whether it's just the language itself or the actual culture, the embodied notion of our language in the acts and behaviors we do, are still happening. And I'm so very excited when I look at this and know that this young child is a product of our tradition and will be able to carry this in throughout her lifetime.
My husband and I had a hard time raising our children. You know, I feel bad for young couples because myself, I can say myself, I never got no help finding out for my child or anything pleased to starve. So Cecil used to walk to town to talk to his friends, and his friends would give him $5 or $6. And the reason I was motioning on, because this young girl, she used to stand there and throw a fit. Her father used to walk to town, and she'd be crying. So that one day, too many times it happened. Hey, Evans. Anyway, they were laying in bed with her, she was laying in bed with her dad, and there was a bird on the ceiling, and she said it was looking at her like that. It came to her. So it's true when you hear the stories that something's going to come to you, and this bird came to her. So that time, my good relative and good friend, Edith Sampson, told me I should name her Kukia. And name stuck to her. It's even on her cell phone. Sit up around it. So we call her Hockey. So I'm thinking, gee, how am I going to beat this name out of her? I was telling Dolores, where is she? Our Mavis, how am I going to get this name away from her? So guys to wave this around at her, see if we can strip her of her name. Then when you guys think you beat it out of her, then you guys go like this and float it over to that little girl. Hey, what shall we say? Kakia, kakia, kakia. Don't beat that banana on her. Turn around, Hockey. Kakia, kakia. This really saved her from her father. Her father, she really loved her father. Kakia, kakia. Turn around, Hockey. Kakia, kakia, kakia. She's gonna get mad at me. Come on, you guys. Kakia, kakia, kakia. Kakia, kakia, kakia. Woo! Now float it over that way, Turks, that little girl. Kakia, kakia. Go in front of her, go in back of her. Kakia, kakia, kakia. Whee! Okay, let's start my baby. Ouchie and Noe. Kakia. Hockey. Okay, we're going to work this back and forth.
At the end, when they finished waving the scarves over the little girl, the woman said, "Now Kakia has arrived." And then she said her nickname, Hockey. And so both the name of the older woman and her nickname were transferred to the young girl. So this is the component of the data that you actually see the actual transmission process happening, where the materiality of the language is being used in a particular strategic way. And also, there's an evoke, a verification of the content of the name and its act and meaning in the life of the first named individual. So that verification, that meaning assessment, is very prominent in many of the rituals, as this woman demonstrated. So it's really becoming more and more a common occurrence to hear meaning assessments being expressed in this manner. Although she said so in English, you did notice that at the beginning, in Sahaptin, she explained the significance of the name, and also the spirit bird that came to that young girl, and then she explained it again in English to her audience. So in conclusion of my talk, I just want to say that the current reanalysis of behavioral signs, or language, as we are calling it, by speakers of endangered languages is an overt attempt to address the contingency and eruption of non-Indigenous codes in the wake of language shift. In doing so, traditional practitioners and speakers are enacting two key strategies. The first, they're becoming intentional agents in the transmission of culture. And by that I mean to point out in the verification process where meaning assessment is an overt conscious act on the part of all practitioners, and that they are engaging meaning assessment throughout the rituals. And I'd like to say that these people who are intentional agents are very exceptional individuals. And then two, they are manifesting a form of purism, not one built on difference, as we've been finding, but rather it's enacted as a linguistic ideology that evokes the idealized ritual person, or the most natural human person who we know and have been raised to be. Thus, the basis for the continuity culture in the Plateau Longhouse tradition is not to simply take actions that are desired by others, but it is one where codes are expertly managed as a means of ensuring their originating transformative capacity and continuity in the face of change. And for that, I thank you for your attention. Thank you.
It's good to hear those words. Thank you. I'm James Crippen. I'm Tlingit, and I work on Tlingit in my own community. And what you showed me here today is very fascinating, because I see the exact same things occurring in my home, in my land. And I wonder, in some ways, I wonder whether this same sort of strategy, we're not very far apart, I'm only up in Alaska, so is this same strategy being adopted out of the exigencies of our culture in its situation, in our language situation? Is this something that seems to be obvious to our elders? It seems to me like you had to really study to figure this out. And I would too, but seeing it presented to me, I can see it's a very simple and very, very culturally embedded, very appropriate way of handling the language loss in the community. I especially wonder, in the home of my clan, there is nobody who speaks our language anymore. And we have in this town several people who are in their 50s who are extraordinary bearers of our tradition, perhaps the most traditional of all of the people in Tlingit society. And yet they speak not a single word of Tlingit. They have been transformed from being ordinary Tlingit people into this new English-speaking Tlingit elder. And is this, I don't want this to be our fate, but is this a way that we can continue if we must? If we have no chance to keep the language, can we continue and keep the culture alive in this manner?
With regard to the elder awareness, I have noticed that Many of the teachings I had from my grandparents were about how to live a good life and how to actually practice living a good life. And anything less than that, you were actually less than human. And so the loss of living a good life is to not live as a human being. And that potential, I think, is part of the motive for some of the efforts that are being made, is that we want, or our elders want us to live as real human beings. And what that means can only be determined by our history and our traditions. And so, to me, when I first started this work and I started hearing elders talk like that, I thought to myself, what could I do? I couldn't sit down and start writing a grammar. I wouldn't be helping the situation. So I bypassed the traditional linguist role for something more and maybe something meaningful. And hopefully I'm going in that direction with this analysis. But in the end, I'm hoping that with the kind of awareness the analysis grants me or begins to bear fruit, that I can actually make recommendations to our community to say that if we're going to revive a tradition or if we're going to protect a tradition, these are at least the minimal elements that you need to be concerned with. And not that I'm going to prescribe any particular behavior, but just say that minimally we can use these elements or these bits of information to do what we need to do to continue our culture and to be the people we're meant to be.
My name is Eyamba Bokamba, originally from the Congo, which used to be called during Mobutu's regime as Zaire. Before Mobutu came into power, it used to be called the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And we have returned back to that. We returned back to Democratic Republic of the Congo without the democracy. And in hearing your presentation, I kept reflecting on issues that have been of considerable interest and sometimes acrimonious debate among Africanist, African scholars. And that is that of language policies which privilege the former colonial powers' languages at the exclusive, let's say, detriment of the indigenous African languages. And I look at the kind of continuing penetration of these former colonial languages, be it English, French, or Portuguese, through the educational system, and find that urbanization is adding to the same kind of effect, which is the gradual erosion of the vitality of those languages and the loss of knowledge of such languages, particularly ethnic languages, through the generations. I'm sort of seeing ahead through your narrative what is likely to happen in Africa. And the unfortunate thing is that many African politicians who are sometimes called leaders, and some of them I don't consider them to be leaders because they didn't lead anybody. They don't know how to lead. Or simply blind to this insidious development And it's occurring. My nieces at one of the universities in the Congo do not know the mother tongue that I know. They know only one of them, Lingala. But Zamba, they don't know. And when I ask them, they say, well, uncle, you see, we live in Kinshasa. Everybody speaks Lingala here. It's a default language. And then at school, French is the official language. So, you know, why worry about Zamba? We understand it. And I asked the mother, I said, but you and the father raised these kids. What happened in the process? So, well, they were not really interested in, you know, learning the language. They want to be like everybody else. Well, what is going to happen is that their children, and I told them, their children will not learn Zamba. And they don't know the kind of information that at least I knew. But even I was somewhat alienated by virtue of the fact of living in a so-called boarding school where I didn't grow up in the village to learn some of the valuable, let's say, names of plants and so on and so on, and how they can be used for the benefit, you know, of the society. And so it is a very poignant, I think, narrative that you have shared with us. And at the same time, I began to worry much more seriously, even though I have taught a course on language endangerment and I mentioned these things, but to hear someone who's experiencing it and who's looking at it from an insider point of view is very striking, and I thank you for that. I just wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, thank you.
Satir no hongo tleone deadle honata au hoje winning hat and is a sliston ahulia atron desne with anata on a genus. Is basically I'm thanking you for what you've said, and to me it was as a fellow Indian of a Hoopa Valley tribe, Northern California. Anyway, it was beautiful how you presented it, and I really liked it. And we would call you what we would call you would have a beautiful spirit in our people's way. But I was wondering, how is it that you, when it comes to language and things that are lost with it, when they use English, because in my language, we don't have a word for life, we just have a word for spirit, and that would be lost, untranslatable when we use it in English in different ways. How do you get the younger people to understand those things that they're missing? And is that a concern of the elders in your area? And how do they address it, or how do you address it? Because for my people and for me, that's a very big issue.
I see in the communities that I worked in that when younger language apprentices wanted to broach certain topics that just knowing the vocabulary wasn't enough, and because they're so important in the worldview of the people and the elders. For example, one girl wanted to know about dreaming and dreams, and it turned into a big hour-long discussion on the role of dreams in our culture, and that the vocabulary kind of initiated this discussion. And so I think when we have elders who really understand and know the way of life, that just the mere vocabulary can really evoke a lot of these important meanings, and if there is some loss, then I think within a generation or two of my life that there may be times when we don't have a word. In fact, people are still talking about modern technologies. How do we translate modern technologies? And many of our elders say, well, we don't need to. It's not really our way or our life. And so it's really an open discussion. And when we're a loss of words, then we're also, the way our elders have been conceptualizing it, we're in a loss of knowledge too. So that kind of two-dimensional idea is what I'm seeing.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, I think it's time to go off the book. So please join me in thanking you.